Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello, Wilder. 3 weeks, I don't think I've seen you with the holidays and everything else. We just haven't been able to connect.
Been chaos.
I know. But before we get to our stuff, are you watching The Gilded Age?
I am.
Are you up to date? I mean, we're actually taping on a Sunday. Can we just talk about how it's just laying a foundation for understanding so many things like the Union standoff last week?
Yeah. They're much kinder to these characters than I think these characters in history were, but
well,
that is to be expected from our Bridgerton friends.
She's referring to the owner of the steel mills and stuff, and these union guys are going on strike, and we're not going to tell you what happens, but there is this moment where you understand the enormity of it, and the steel mill owner has a heart, which I think you're referring to maybe in real life. They don't.
I think I'm maybe referring to JP Morgan.
Okay, well, I wasn't gonna cast any aspersions on some of my friends, but at any rate, he's talking to the guy who's sort of running the show in Pittsburgh. And he said, look, I went to talk to this guy and his kids were home. They should have been in school. Do we even have schools? And do you remember what the guy says to him?
I don't know, and I don't want to know.
I don't care.
Yeah.
And it was riveting. And the divide between the classes, between the haves and the have-nots, all through the whole thing.
I will say this last episode finally let me figure out exactly when this is set. I know it's post-Civil War, but it's not quite... Downton starts in 1911, right? So I knew it was before then.
The day after the Titanic sinks. Yeah.
So you know when that is. And in this, it's kind of nebulous. It's not very clear. Like, you know, it's between the end of the Civil War and the invention of the automobile. It's somewhere in between those two events. But it's not very clear, like, who's president or where, when exactly this is taking place. And part of that I was curious about because of the Black storyline in the show, because she's been raised her whole life in the North.
Yeah.
Right. And her boss was a slave.
Right.
And so I was like, wait, how long after the Civil War is this? And they actually shed some light in this last episode of when this is, because they're talking about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, well, Miss Millennial, to give you some perspective, there are people alive today whose great grandparents were slaves.
Yeah. Benjamin Harrison. Benjamin Harrison has a grandson who's still alive today.
Well, can I just say that alone? It just shows it's not that long ago. It just wasn't. It's
no, absolutely not.
I am very much
enjoying the show.
Well, it's funny. It's Julian Fellowes who did Downton Abbey, and then he came over to do this. That man did his homework, and he understands America. America's very different than Britain, but, you know, very different. And he's very British. I mean, he hasn't spent a lot of time here. And I think he does a really good job of creating the same kind of storyline that we saw in Downton, upstairs, downstairs, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But he didn't bring Britain over to America. He really did it from what it was like here, which was very, very different. Anyway, I highly recommend it, don't you?
I think it's delightful. I don't think it's incredibly hard hitting. And I don't know that it's the most accurate, but it is delightful.
Well, in today's world, I'm not sure I can take hard hitting right now.
Sure.
I'm just saying.
Yes.
Okay. So, All right. So you sent me a text and said, hey, I'm going to watch May, December. Do you want to do that this weekend? And I was like, sure. And I had read about it. But I don't know how to thank you. I owe you my whatever. I don't know. Let me just do a pretty big introduction and then we can, I'll turn it over to you. But Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman, like, they're the stars in This Is Todd Haynes. And I didn't realize it. Todd Haynes disquieting May, December, you know, and I thought, what's it? I kept thinking to myself, why are they doing this? And then once I saw who the director was, I was like, oh, well, that explains it. What's it about? Okay. Anyone remember Mary Kay Letourneau?
Letourneau. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was that school teacher who slept with a seventh grader. Actually, I think she first came on to when he was 12. But anyway, in the film, he's around 13. And then went to prison and had two of his children while she was in prison. Because they let her out. She went back to him, got pregnant again, and then they put her back in prison. Okay.
Yep.
They married when she got out. And eventually, 20 years later, they divorced. But then when she was dying of cancer, he came and was by her side, never left her sides for the 2 months as she fought it and then lost that war. So Todd Haynes, who you'll remember him, I mean, he doesn't tell that story. No. Which is so like him. He brings Natalie Portman to the town. Gracie, aka Mary Kay, lives in with her family while she studies them because she's going to play her in the film about her life. And it just gets creepier from there as these two brilliant actors, they get intertwined into something close to The Shining, but without murder at its end. Okay, so look, Haynes is known for loving to go behind the scenes of what something seems to be. I mean, let's look at Carol, and then another, you know, which was another forbidden love story, but not about necessarily the love story. Or Far Away from Heaven, you know, another, you know, yeah, exactly.
So first Julianne Moore.
It's not exactly not, you know, I think she's done six films with him, but yeah. Not unusual for him to not tell the story that you think you're going to learn, but tell the story behind the story. I think it was amazingly brilliant. And now I turn it over to you, Wilder. What do you say?
I mean, I am still unsettled from watching this movie.
It's really unsettling. It is.
And Todd Haynes he's deft, right? He's incredibly clever with how he handles the camera, how he tells you a story, and if he's even telling you a story. You know, I think he is unsure what he wants you to feel, and
I don't really
you will be
there.
Unsure
I don't,
as
I don't
you're
think
watching
he's
it
trying to make me feel anything. I think he's just
oh I think it. He is well, and I think if you look to anything, it's the score. The score is so over represented in this in a great
funny
way.
It's almost, you know what, yeah, what did it remind you of? Jaws.
Well, and it's actually, the score is actually it's a cover, it's a score from a previous film from the 70s.
But not only that, like, there's something almost funny about it because it's so over the top.
Yeah, and unbelievably ominous.
Yeah, and that in a way it actually lightens your load rather than making it heavier, in my opinion. So
one of the first scenes, Julianne Moore she's brilliant in this, but she's also
both are by the way.
There's so many layers because Julianne Moore is playing a fictional version of Mary Kay Letourneau, and Natalie Portman is playing an actress who's coming to play another fictional version of this character.
But you know what's even more important is, in my mind, Natalie Portman is playing a second-rate actor.
Yeah.
So because you can see, she shows you, I'm acting here, but she's not that good at it. But that, I think, is all contrived also. So, you know, he doesn't just leave it as she's an actress coming to play this role. Mm-hmm. She's also an actress who became famous on some stupid, you know.
Yeah, she has a lot to prove.
A series that clearly had had no depth to it.
I mean, it's called Nora's Ark.
Well, it was supposed to be called the Animal Vet or Animal Hospital, but they couldn't, the night before they shot the scene, they couldn't get permission. So they had to change it that night. And she said she was really glad they did. But that's where his brilliance is. Every single time you think, oh, that's what he's going to do, you realize, no, he's doing even more than that. So not only is Natalie Portman playing an actress, but she's playing she's not a good actress. Yeah.
And it's really beautifully put together. It's very unsettling. You never know. You think you come in with expectations of what this is going to be and how you're supposed to feel about it. And at every scene, he throws you a curveball of what you think you're watching and who you're supposed to be rooting for. And, you know, Natalie Portman's character at every turn becomes more and more confusing. And what her motivations are become confusing who she actually is.
Didn't it remind you of Black Swan a bit?
A little bit. That one feels more like a personal psychological thriller of a woman devolving.
Reminded me of that too, though. I mean, you know, I don't want to do spoilers. So there's a scene where she does something that's just, it's worse than cruel. It is designed to devastate. And then her answer to the question about it is, well, that's what grownups do. You know, like, you know, it's just, she really, I think she's evil. I think she's got evil in her.
Yeah, it's funny because you go into the movie trying to figure out what the hell is up with Gracie, right? What's up with Julianne Moore's character? And you come out being like, wait, hang on. This was entirely about someone else.
They are both not good representatives of our gender. But here's the other thing. So get this. This is where, you know, he kept talking. I watched a bunch of interviews with him about this film. And he kept talking about, look, when you're working with these two people, you can do things you can't do with others because that's how good they are. And one of the things that Julianne Moore said is, look, Natalie Portman, as the film goes on, I have a little bit of a lisp in this film. And she, halfway through the film, she starts taking on my mannerisms and my speech patterns, but she didn't tell her she was going to do that. Mm-hmm. And Julianne Moore said, it took me 2/3 of the movie to figure out she'd done it. That's how good she was at it. Mm-hmm. I was so busy playing me, you know, in this role that I didn't see her coming up behind me, taking me on and becoming me. In it, which, by the way, I mean, you have to admit, that's pretty damn good, you know, pretty damn.
Yeah, I mean, watching it, you watch her kind of transform into Gracie throughout the whole movie. And then, I mean, there's a beautiful payoff at the end of how not good an actress she actually is playing. And you have to be a really good actress to play being not a good actor, right? You have to be incredible. And they both are. I will say Charles Melton, who plays Joe, who's the husband in this, I think is this beautiful, quiet center. This just all of the sadness of this story just pours out through him.
You see a little bit of ironic comedy almost in the first half, and then you start to see the depth of the sadness. But the other thing is, he gained 40 pounds for this role, which is a lot of weight. That's a lot of weight on. And I looked him up. He's been in a lot of films, like 20 films, but I don't remember him from it. Most of them I had not seen, you know.
Oh, so. he's big from the CW. That's where, you know, I don't know that you're spending a ton of time there.
Now, Natalie Portman brought the script to Todd Haynes as a potential collaboration between the two. And Haynes immediately said yes. He loved it. And then he suggested Julianne Moore for the role opposite Portman. Now, he'd worked with her so many times, it's not surprising that he asked for her. But, you know, apparently she was thrilled to get it. But I think the screenplay, who, by the way, is you know, when I'm looking at this screenplay and I'm thinking, okay, it's Sammy Birch who wrote it. But she's not known. She did a lot of casting for most of the Hunger Games in the Hunger Games series. She's been a casting agent more than a screenwriter. But you know, I realized when I thought about it, this is her first major script. And I think she's going to get a nod. I think she should if she does, you know, if she, I think it was really a good screenplay. But because again, the screenplay was executed brilliantly by these two very talented actors. But the reason they took it is they read it and they saw how really, how they saw how amazing an opportunity she was giving them to play two characters that were so filled with layers that it would be really fun to do. So I think she was really good. I thought she was great. So good for Sammy Birch, right?
Yeah, I read this script. It was on the 2020 blacklist. So every year, the industry votes its best unproduced scripts. It's called the blacklist. And this was pretty high up on it, 3 years ago. It's an incredible turnaround for a script to go from being written to being shot and released. So, I mean, kudos to them. And I remember there was quite the fervor over this when it first came out.
Well, it debuted in Cannes and Netflix picked it up for $11 million. And they then brought it there, you know, went to Netflix really quickly, very soft launch outside of before Netflix. I'm not sure why they pay. That's not an insignificant number to pay. So I'm not sure why they picked it up when they weren't going to do more with it outside of that. I think they picked it up for awards. I do. I think.
Well, what's interesting is that they've submitted it for the Golden Globes under comedy.
Well, you know, he talks about it. Did you watch any of the Hayes interviews or did you read?
No.
The, yeah. Mm-hmm. You got to do that sometimes because he talks about the comedy of it. And the New York Times reviewer, who I think wrote the best review that I read of it. And who is that? Okay. It's Manola Dargis. Do you know, he really good reviews, but he talks about that in the screening room, he kept trying to cover his mouth because he wasn't sure he was supposed to laugh, but he found himself laughing. And so did I. And part of that in my mind was Natalie Portman's over the top playing of a terrible actor and trying to get along with somebody who she couldn't stand. I mean, the whole, you know, it was comedic. I get it. I get why they thought it was a comedy. I do.
I didn't find it funny. I mean, there were moments that I thought were kind of funny, but I would not have pegged this for comedy. I would have said this is pretty intense drama. And I was unbelievably uncomfortable for most of the film. And I think that was the intent.
But even the music was funny. It was like,
I mean, everything is absurd and over the top, but it's
because the music was as if someone was going to be murdered and nobody was, and you knew it.
So, yeah, but it's, you know, this is also a story of questionable child abuse. I mean, there's a big scene between Joe and Gracie towards the end of everything that's been dredged up from this visit. And apparently it's based on a real interview with Mary Kay and Billy. Where she flat out asks him, who was the boss? Who was the boss? And when you're talking about a 13-year-old and a 36-year-old woman, that it's terrifying that that's the conversation many years later they're still having.
Well, they actually have that. She asks that question in the film. Yeah. That's not giving anything away. It doesn't ever get answered. As a viewer, I thought the answer he was supposed to say was, I am.
Well, that's what she has told him the whole time.
Yeah, but, you know, everybody knows that it isn't. But also, so the title, May, December, did you look it up?
I know what a May, December romance is. That's, you know, what's funny, though, is that I mentioned it and my fiance had no idea what I was talking about. Apparently, it's not a colloquialism in the way that I thought it was.
Well, yeah, why don't you tell, so you share them what the title, where it comes from.
A May-December romance is when one party is much older than the other.
No, actually, in the definition, it refers to a relationship where a younger woman is involved with an older man. And what's funny about that is, in this case, it's the exact reverse of it, which is also humorous, because when they came up with the term May-December, the older women were not.
No,
young, you know, so
that could never happen.
But that's, again, one of the humorous things about it is it's supposed to be based on an older man and, you know, sort of.
Yeah,
that's not the case. So and then December refers to, you know, the end of his vitality, the end of his darkness of winter. And, you know, even that is funny. It's sort of, I mean, I get it. I think there was a lot in there that sort of made me laugh. But our listeners can't see your face. When I talked about how great the screenplay was, you were sort of like, not so much.
I liked it. I think it's well crafted. It's one of those that if you don't get the right actors and the right director, right, it could go any number of ways. And I think, you know, this landed in the right hands, and that's a gift that it did.
Well, and by the way, that's what Hayes said over and over again. He said, look, he said he does a lot of this where he puts the camera, they're talking into a mirror. They're in a bathroom. They're in her bathroom. She's showing her how to put on makeup. There's a number of places where they look into the camera, which is supposed to be a mirror. So we get to see as if they were looking into the mirror. And he said, It's an interesting technique that people use, he said, but the actors have to be so good. For the one scene he's talking about where they're putting on makeup, and the two actors, I mean, Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman, just keep you hanging for a really long time. They keep you waiting. They are brilliant, absolutely brilliant in their depiction of it. So a lot of the camera uses, he says he can't do with everybody, but he could do it with them because that's how good they are.
Yeah, it's amazing because it's hard. It's hard when you're watching it because Julianne Moore, her character is wild, right? But she ends up playing second fiddle to Natalie Portman. And I think that's such a testament to Julianne Moore's acting,
yeah,
that you just kind of take in hand that that's who she is. And she's never reflected on who she is and who, if she did something wrong here, or if there's should be consequences or any, like there's an innocence and a naivete.
She doesn't have to look at it, you know?
Yeah. There's a naivete to her character that she knows she has, and she hides behind because she wants to, and it makes her life digestible for her. And it's remarkable because you just take it for granted when you're watching it, because Natalie Portman is so interesting and confusing and all of those things that you think are going to be Gracie but end up being Elizabeth.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the other thing that I think is so cool, there's one scene, it takes place at the dining room table, and we see to our left and to our right are Natalie's character and Julianne Moore's character, and then straight ahead is his character. And it goes on for a long time. Sorry. It's 6 pages of dialogue, which is a lot to learn. Anyway, he never speaks, but the camera constantly goes to him because in those moments, you're learning about the dynamic between she and her husband that is so messed up. That's like a 12-year-old still looking to his teacher to tell him what to think. The way he nods yes. I think that, you know, if anyone watches that, he's going to get a nod or two because it's really brilliant acting on his part.
Oh, yeah. He's completely trapped in his 12-year-old role. I mean, there's a moment where you see kind of Gracie break down a bit. And even the way he comforts her feels like a child comforting a parent.
Well, exactly.
Rather than, you know, two equals.
But to be able to give us the depth, to show us the entire relationship, it's pretty early on. And we get to see exactly what's going on and to do it without one word in the dialogue that's going back and forth. Brilliant. I mean,
the whole concept is wild. I mean, she's coming to visit during their kids' graduation week. It's like, and it's, it's inevitable that there's going to be drama because they live in the same town as her previous family, and her grandchildren are also graduating at the same time as her children. And it's just, and it's, you know, they live in small town Savannah. So they're going to run into each other. And it's like, well, did she plan it this way? Is this the way the timing worked out? Like, did she want her to come when there was going to be drama happening? Is that what she thinks she has to offer? Like, it's just, the whole thing is fascinating. Her son, her relationship with her son is fascinating to me, that he still lives there. Like, there's a great scene where Natalie is meeting with her lawyer, who was the one who, you know, showed up at the jail and had to reveal to her that she'd done something wrong, that she'd broken a law. And her son, Julianne Moore's son, is there, her elder son, who's the same age as her now husband, right? Was in the same class as her now husband. And he's a trip, and you have no idea what's true with him, what's real or not. But the whole time I'm wondering, why do you still live there? You're grown. You don't have to live there anymore. Yeah, you could have left.
He answers that question. He's, you know, basically ruined his life. You know, there was no life after that.
Right. But then also that you're thrown many twists and turns in that relationship as well. And you don't know what to believe at the end of it.
It's brilliant. But it's part of the brilliance in my mind, I want to bring this back to you, is the screenplay. Because I think Hayes did a great job shooting it, no question. But he didn't write it. And at first I thought he must have written this, but he didn't. And I think the screenplay is so good. It gives the director so much to work with and the actor so much to work with that it's one of the reasons why I call it a great screenplay. So it'll be interesting to see if it gets a nod. I'll be willing to wager you here that it does. Just giving you a little wager on here. So we'll see.
Well, I'm curious. I'm also curious if it does, in what category. Is it adapted? Because there's an argument for it.
No, there's no book that it was adapted from. No.
But there's a story that it's adapted from.
Well, no.
There's a very famous story it's adapted from. Well, Barbie's being considered adapted. Yeah,
but they don't go there in the interviews. They don't do any of that. In the interviews, they totally steered clear of it, which tells me they're not going to go down that route.
No, I know, but sometimes they don't have a choice. Sometimes they are relegated.
But there have been a lot, but there have been more than one. There have been many cases like this, similar to this. So it's not like.
I'm just saying, if Barbie's up for best adapted screenplay, why wouldn't this be?
Please don't make me talk about Barbie again.
I'm just saying the categories and the qualifications are interesting.
This is on Netflix. I think we both think you shouldn't miss it, but also I don't think it's a family film. I really think you have to,
not at all.
I do not think anyone under the age of even 18 should be watching this film. No. There's too many things in there that nobody needs to think about right now with everything else we need to think about. So I would have your kids steer clear of it, but I would certainly watch it. I think it's really, really good.
Just be prepared to be uncomfortable when you're watching it.
And by the way, and to carry that discomfort for a couple of days afterward, I watched it yesterday. I'm still a little torn. But now I got to ask you before we sign off, you saw Maestro. I haven't seen it yet. Any thoughts?
You should go see it.
Okay, so maybe we should review it.
I don't know if we have time with what's happening in the world right now, but I think Bradley Cooper is a really good director. I think he's so charismatic, and it's not his movie, which I loved.
Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. That's so mysterious. I can't wait to look that up and find out what that means. I will go see it to figure it out. But the other thing is, you and I never talked about A Star Is Born, which was his first major directorial debut. Did you never see it?
I haven't seen it yet. Don't yell at me. Okay.
All right. Well, I'm not going to yell at you. I frankly thought the movie didn't need to be remade four times. So,
it's one of the most remade.
Yeah, I saw it at the Hamptons Film Festival, but it was sort of like, I don't know why this. I already saw this. You know, Barbara Streisand. Never saw that connection on that one. I don't know. Anyway. All right. Well, I hope you have a great week, and we will
talk
soon. And thanks for putting this on my plate. Really, really, really grateful.
Glad I could help.